Hi, y'all, and welcome back to All Swell. We are a student-led podcast sponsored by the Coastal Society and Coastal News Today on the American Shoreline Podcast Network. I'm Genevieve Gary, a PhD candidate in Integrated Coastal Sciences at ECU. Today, we are joined by Sean Charles, a postdoc here at the Coastal Studies Institute in the Outer Banks. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah.
Long time listener, first time guest.
Oh, thank you. We love to have a listener finally come on the podcast. So just to start us off, can you just give us a little bit about your background and what led you to becoming a marine scientist and coming here to the Outer Banks?
Absolutely. But cut me off if I get long-winded. It's sort of a long story. But basically, I grew up very much outdoors, so grew up in Southeast Virginia near Williamsburg, actually Jamestown, where the first settlers came, and grew up fishing and being outside, and wetlands were always kind of a special place in my mind, particularly because no one went there. So there were these swamps and forests near where you lived that were just kind of peaceful and quiet. And so that's kind of how I started going into wetlands. But basically, I've always been excited about wetlands, about fishing, swimming, surfing, etc. And didn't find out until quite a bit later that that could become a career.
Yeah. So. I know. I think it's funny because like everybody's like, oh my God, I wanted to be a marine like scientist when I'm young. Whenever I tell somebody and they're like, oh my God, I just, and the first thing they do too is like jump to like dolphin trainer. Like right. I don't know if that's just like an 80s, 90s kids thing where it's just like we saw SeaWorld or we watched like Free Willy and it was like, oh my God, that's like the only path in marine science. And I think the same thing because I went when I was younger, like into the salt marsh and stuff with my dad. And I'm like, I didn't really think about studying that. I just liked the coast, you know?
No, and in some ways I think studying wetlands is almost the opposite of studying dolphins.
It's,
it's the least kind of attractive in the popular culture rather than kind of dolphins being really charismatic megafauna. I'm studying dirt and little plants.
I know, but they're important because, you know, I think when I worked down in South Carolina, like we would always teach the kids that like, you know, the dolphins here on the East Coast would like hunt in packs of three and they would actually like come up and like up into some of the marsh areas depending on how deep they were and push the fish up there to like collect them. And some of the kids would refer to them as murder pods. And I was like, that, you know, I don't know if that's the exact right term for the dolphins. But so there is that link between the charismatic megafauna and the marsh.
And oh, yeah. And you know, that was a big part of why I got involved is that marshes and wetlands are incredible. So they're home to 50% of our threatened and endangered species in this country, at least in part of their lives. So a lot of the reason that I was there was fishing and bird watching, things like that to begin with. And then it evolved into understanding the ecosystems further and why they were important and how we could protect them. But I will say that I have had some wonderful dolphin interactions in wetlands. So.
Yeah, I've had a couple. I think the coolest interaction that I've seen like has to see the mom teaching the baby like how to breathe and going up on, you know, and seeing them come back up and everything. And I used to work on an environmental tour boat. And if I had a dollar for every time I heard, oh, when are the dolphins going to appear? I would probably be able to pay off my student loans by now because they always want to see. But I always liked seeing all the other critters. Like a lot of people don't know that actually like raccoons too in coastal areas like to be in the wetlands and they'll go and they'll break open and they eat the oysters and everything. So that's always fun. Because I think people, they just see it, but they don't actually think about the animal interaction in the marsh as well.
Absolutely.
Which is so cool. So speaking of wetlands, marshes, do you have like a favorite one you like to visit? Or, you know, I mean, obviously you research them too. So do they overlap or do they different?
I love going into wetlands. There are certainly some that are particularly near and dear to my heart. I think that actually here in eastern North Carolina, we have some of the most underrated natural places in the whole country, and those happen to be wetlands. So like the Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge, there's nowhere else in the country that you could see red. Well, there are no other places with red wolves. And then we have bears, we have snakes, all kinds of incredible migratory birds come through the area. Fish, marine life, you name it, this is a pretty cool place. But before getting here, so I love doing research here, but most of my research for my PhD was in the Everglades.
Oh, yeah.
And that has a very special place in my heart as well.
Yeah. So how did you, we kind of jumped the gun, how did you then get down to Florida and work in the Everglades?
Yeah, so I did my undergrad at William & Mary in Virginia. And so I think that we have a little bit of a problem in this country about how we teach biology. You learn all of the kind of tedious specifics right away before you understand how it relates to the environment. So I came into undergrad not at all interested in being a biology major.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And then I was an English major and then ended up realizing towards the end that once you break through the Bio 100 level courses and get into some ecology classes, that that was actually, you know, a big part of my passion. So I got a double major in environmental science as well.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I got to brag on my alma mater a little bit. The reason why I went to South Carolina for marine science, because I knew I was getting bored in high school. Like, I needed to start learning marine science. We had marine science 101. Like, that was the first class I took at South Carolina, like, period. Mm-hmm. And so that was great because then I had, like, a real understanding of some basic oceanography. And then I could go into those classes and I could see them automatically. So I was taking bio and marine science at the same time, which is really nice. Though I think I would have probably benefited from more English classes because my writing was atrocious. And I've seen papers back from undergrad and I was like, even my master's, I was like, oh, wow. It took me up until like my PhD to actually start trying to write better and bringing in more of that style because we're so like lab intensive of like, and we put this and we mix this in the beaker and then we went out and, you know, looked at this transect and everything. So you were at William & Mary and then where did you go from there?
Yeah, well, just on the English major thing real quick is that I will say that it doesn't necessarily help you to read, you know, postmodern poets and then use that as your template for writing science
papers.
Yeah,
I can see that,
kind of like the opposite kind of writing. Whereas in science, we often have to remove a lot of the kind of creative aspects of it. But after undergrad, I had an internship where I worked for an environmental think tank called the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C. And I realized during that I didn't really know enough about science to drive my own investigations. And so my idea was that I was just going to go get a master's and then go back into journalism.
Interesting. Okay, that's cool.
But in the process, I got kind of, I got really excited about science.
Yeah. I think then you kind of discover that you have questions for like everything in the environment. And that's what keeps most people, you know, that's why they do a PhD is because they have like nonstop questions. Like, I joke that I have like a million and one dissertation ideas, but I just need to finish the one idea that I have now. Did you kind of find that the same?
Yeah, I mean, I had a ton of ideas. Just as an idea, after that process, before I actually went back to grad school, I became an apprentice winemaker.
Oh, wow.
And then I started a company called Backyard Farmer, where we set up vegetable gardens in people's backyards and for schools and restaurants and
things like
the prison system ended up employing us to do that.
So, that's awesome, though. That's really cool and probably much needed, too, like to give people, I would think, with prisoners, like that kind of like hand-on experience to like, you know, take the time, be outside, build something, and then see the fruits of the labor from that.
Yeah. But, you know, the idea the whole time was that I wanted to do something positive for the world, and I wasn't quite sure what the topic would be. And then ultimately ended up on wetlands being kind of the subject that I could do the most positive good in for the world. And so I ended up going to the Virginia Institute of Marine Science and doing a master's, and then moving to South Florida to do a PhD at Florida International University in Miami.
Awesome. Now, how was that transition going from, like, you know, the Virginia area down to Miami?
I mean, Miami's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
it was fun, though. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting things to do in Miami. There's, you know, the Miami nightlife scene is not quite what I'm interested in. Yeah. But just in the area there, you have the Everglades, you have the Keys, you have quite a few really interesting natural areas.
Yeah, I have to say, I do love going down to the Keys. I love seeing the mangroves. I got a chance to study them when I did a study abroad in Australia. And I'm just like, because it's so different from what we have more up here in the North and South Carolina area with our grasses, really. Mm-hmm. And so seeing the mangroves and seeing the fish kind of like go in between them and everything. And I know that's really a big thing we do. We study here at CSI. So we've kind of like talked a lot about kind of what we've been doing, but I think we should maybe get a little bit back to basics. So why are wetlands so important?
So basically, a lot of the problems that we've caused to the planet and therefore to ourselves as humans can be the best way to fix a lot of them is through wetlands. So we haven't been able to create anything technologically that creates all the benefits that wetlands do. So they clean the water, so they basically remove nutrients, excess nutrients that drive eutrophication and fish die-offs and dead zones, etc. They're the best mechanism that we have so far in terms of removing those nutrients before they reach the waterways. They provide habitat for 50% of our threatened and endangered species. They are really important for most of our commercial fisheries in terms of at least some life stage in the fish's life. And they're the best ecosystem that we have in terms of dealing with climate change. So they take CO2 out of the atmosphere, and they, through photosynthesis, and then they build up the plant biomass, and then ultimately they build the elevation of the soil by taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and adding it as organic matter to the soil. So by doing that, they're both fighting climate change by removing CO2, and they're also protecting people and communities from climate change by building up the soil and therefore blocking flooding.
Yeah, they really are one of our best line of defenses.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to put it. And I think it is an area of opportunity for the future for us to deal with climate change. And so we are currently in one of the largest kind of like wetland systems here in the Albemarle Pamlico Sound. So I'm sorry, my enunciation is not the best. And so how have wetlands, though, been viewed in the past?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. And it's one that I think about a lot. So if you think about some of the names of our most famous wetlands in the U.S. in the past of them, they've been totally undervalued and basically hated. So you think about something like the Great Dismal Swamp, for example. George Washington was actually the first one to talk about draining it. So basically, these wetlands were seen as a nuisance because you couldn't farm them in their current state. You couldn't develop on them. So a lot of times they were just considered places to either fill or dredge so that you could either build on them, farm on them, or alternatively drive a boat through them, which wetlands are generally too shallow to get a boat through. So they named them things like the Great Dismal Swamp, and they set about trying to change them from wetlands.
Yeah, so it's funny you say, I did not know that about George Washington. Going back to when I worked in South Carolina, like, we always talked about how, like, in the Revolutionary War, like, we used them to our advantage. And that's where some of, like, guerrilla warfare came from. And that was from Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox. You know, so in South Carolina, they're, like, I think viewed a little bit more because of that history with the Revolutionary War.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just the Revolutionary War. They played a played a big role in all kinds of scenarios where people have had to escape. For example, one of the main stops on the Underground Railroad was right through the Great Dismal Swamp. Tons of escaped slaves ended up in the Great Dismal Swamp and created these maroon communities that lasted for decades, where they and Native American people kind of mingled and hid out from the more powerful.
And I know, especially here, we're kind of we're a little bit too north in the Outer Banks, but you go a little bit more south in Wilmington, that's kind of where the Gullah Geechee Trail starts and goes into South Carolina and then into Georgia. And I know that's been brought up in conversations about how that, like you just said, they use the swamps to their advantages to get out of slavery. It's really fascinating that wetlands have had that impact then, on our culture. As in the Americas.
And now you mentioned the Gullah Geechee. I just want to give a shout out to my friend Queen Quet. If you're listening, she's the queen of the Gullah Geechee that I met kind of recently.
Oh, really? Yeah, she's great. I've gotten to hear her talk one time at the North Carolina Coastal Conference. And if any of our listeners are not familiar with the Gullah Geechee culture, I definitely highly recommend learning, because a lot of our Southern culture actually comes from the Gullah Geechee, and they know so much about our coastal wetlands, and they have so many, we kind of talk about local ecological knowledge. They are definitely kind of a source for that, and really should be taken, in my opinion, more seriously because of that LEK. So we've just kind of talked about how wetlands have had this effect kind of on us socially, environmentally, and everything. When did we start actually putting an economic dollar, valuing wetlands? What do you say?
Well, I mean, so just to go back to that, I think the point or the outcome of this kind of lack of value given to wetlands is that in this country we've lost over half of them. They've either been filled or drained. And so in terms of financial value, it's a tough question, really. I would say that when they were started to be protected, though, was the Clean Water Act in 1977. And so that protection kind of provided a lot of benefit to those, or basically allowed us to protect all of our wetlands in the U.S. But I will say that, we still have presidential candidates running on slogans like "Drain the Swamp." We're not exactly quite to a level of education about their value.
Yeah. Well, it all comes down to definition, right? Defining a wetland, because sometimes they have water in them all the time. Sometimes. Right. They only have water in them when you've had a flooding event.
Yeah.
And so I think that is where the law has had a problem, is because there's been defining in the Clean Water Act. We could have a whole nother podcast about why that needs to come up to 20 times.
Yeah.
But the definition is really hard. I think really for me, when I think about even including economics into marine science, was during Hurricane Katrina. And when they kind of talked about the flooding was made so much worse because they have dredged through pretty much that giant wetland, which is which is more of a river delta.
Yeah.
And everything, for those, if you really think about looking just at the bottom half of Louisiana, it is all wetland.
We were just there 2 weeks ago in Barataria Bay.
Oh, cool.
And it is amazing to see. And it's also amazing to see how fast those wetlands are being lost. So we chose sites based on imagery from 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And we went down there just 2 weeks ago. And some of the sites no longer existed.
Wow.
So within 2 years, you see this huge loss. So we were driving our boat through areas that were previously wetlands, so 2 years ago.
Wow. And now they're just completely water
Yeah.
covered. Because when is it, is it when is it like high tide or is it low tide that you defined it as completely gone? Or is it just covered in water all the time?
So in this case, all the plants are gone. Okay. Everything's eroded away.
So some of that submerged vegetation. Yeah.
But speaking of the Clean Water Act, so that has been kind of the most important law that we have in this country for a while in terms of wetlands, because they've all been protected, all types. So some of those temporary wetlands you were just mentioning, wetlands that are permanently flooded, et cetera. But now there's just recently, this year, been a new court case in the Supreme Court. It was the Sackett versus EPA course.
Yes.
And basically, the Supreme Court, so we used to kind of have a pretty good definition of what wetlands were protected.
Yeah.
And that included lots of wetlands. So we have a definition for wetlands, which is kind of vague. It's basically that they have wetland adapted vegetation, hydric soils, and the presence of water at sometimes, a wetland hydrology. But now, and a lot of that wetland hydrology is groundwater rather than surface water. So there are tons of wetlands all over that are fed by groundwater.
Yep.
Now the Supreme Court has ruled that the only wetlands that are protected under the Clean Water Act are those that are permanently connected through a continuous surface flow. So that could potentially, we're looking at the impacts of that in that Albemarle, Pamlico Sound area.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, could potentially remove protection from the majority of all wetlands.
Wow.
And how it's going to be interpreted is currently in the courts. So it's a little bit, kind of undermines a lot of what we've done for decades to protect wetlands.
I think it really highlights why a policy is so important. And as scientists that we do, I mean, it's hard to have a little bit of knowledge on everything, but at the end of the day, you do kind of have to know some policy behind, you know, what you're doing and how your research could then help and what, you know, what would stand in court. I think that a lot about with what I do with the PFAS. And one of the things I've talked about, because they're thinking of making the Port of Wilmington bigger, is that they have found that these wetlands have actually taken up PFAS in them because they bioaccumulate in the environment. We've seen it in pine needles. They've been finding PFAS in the sea foam. And so the wetlands could actually be a way in which they are getting stored somewhere a little bit. And if you then dredge them up, they're going to be re-released into the environment, either through the water or through the air. That's going to add into already the public kind of health hazard. And so I think about that a lot of like, okay, well, if we're, you know, why do we have to increase building on the coast? We already know it's so sensitive. We know some of these wetlands in some areas are sensitive, in some areas they're more resilient.
Yeah. And I think that you kind of outlined the trajectory of where like my research focus has gone and also kind of our understanding of the threats towards wetlands. So started off talking about the policy aspect. And so traditionally that's kind of why I got into wetlands is that, you know, through better policy, the idea is that we can protect more wetlands. And that traditionally has been the main threat to wetlands is humans directly impacting them. But now things are becoming more and more impacted by climate change. So that's becoming one of the larger threats to wetlands rather than direct human impact. And when you mentioned PFAS, I think that one of the really interesting things is that now that we have sea level rise and enhanced storms hitting wetlands, there's a good chance that those marshes will be eroded and that will be re-released into the atmosphere based on storms rather yeah. than even building.
Well, yeah, and then we're losing, I mean, if you think of any of the coastal communities kind of near these wetlands, if they're gone, they're then going to lose their barrier of defense right. for the next storm, or maybe kind of like a kink's, depending on the tidal influence of the area that they live in. You know, I know down in South Carolina, you know, if you get a king's tide on a Sunday, I mean, there's sunny day flooding down in Charleston all the time. And just to kind of go back a little bit, you mentioned that you used used imageries when you went down to Louisiana. So could you tell me more a little bit about the actual research yeah. methods that you use and kind of, because there's a lot of ways. I mean, I know you can take soil transects of marshes. I know you can use imagery. Yeah. What do you do specifically?
Yeah, so I was more of a field ecologist at first.
Okay.
And so that usually meant going out and measuring plants and soils and looking for changes based on what we knew was happening very locally or based on experiments. So us, say, increasing the salinity in specific marshes or things like that. But now, to try to basically understand what's happening at a larger level, I'm also using a lot of remote sensing data. So just to kind of give you an idea of what those things mean. So one of my experiments during my PhD was because salt water is intruding into coastal marshes that can be freshwater marshes in this case, we basically went to a marsh in the Everglades and added salt to it to try to determine, and phosphorus to try to determine how local human impacts might affect that marsh. We found some interesting things. So we found that, for example, when these marshes get saltwater intrusion, they can actually lose elevation through the die-off of roots
and
increase in decomposition.
I hadn't thought about that yet.
Yeah, and so up to 3 centimeters in 1 year when you increase from fresh to about 5 parts per thousand. So it's not very much. And that actually, if you're talking about relative sea level rises, 10 times faster than the rate of sea level rise right now.
Oh,
so
wow.
We have these major impacts that are coming based on saltwater intrusion. But point of this was that, so you can look at that on a local level and try to understand the mechanisms involved in these changes that you expect in the environment. But to actually see whether it's happening or not, it's really useful to be able to look from satellite imagery. So now a lot of what I'm doing is combining on the ground research with working with NASA to use their satellites to look back at the Earth from space. So
wow.
People know that NASA spends their time looking into space, but also they allow us to look back at Earth. So we use those images to look at changes over time and to see how ecosystems are changing.
Now, for those that don't know, and I know I don't because I don't do remote sensing, does that also involve using drones or kind of more localized kind of imagery than just using satellites?
Yeah, anything where you're not directly measuring it yourself can be considered remote sensing.
Oh,
but
okay.
We use drones. We use these little tiny little Z boats that basically are like remote control boats that drive around for you that you can look at the bathymetry with.
Oh, that's so cool. I'd never heard of those before.
Yeah. So we're just doing this project in the Everglades with NASA where we flew planes over that were equipped with devices to detect carbon dioxide and methane.
Oh, yeah.
From the ecosystem. So, yeah, we use all kinds of tools, but the kind of longest data set we have is from the satellite imagery, which goes back 40 years.
Wow. I didn't know they had gone, but I mean, that you could really go look that closely that far, which I think really helps because I know a lot of times in ecology, it's kind of hammered in our heads, like, you know, like the steady state, like is the environment in a steady state and what was it at, but like historically, and that's something I know that will come up possibly in court, is they're like, oh, well, the ecosystem was already, even if humans didn't impact it, it was already changing without, us. And I think that going back the 40 years and saying, well, no, this is what the environment looked like here, you know, and you can be in a new steady state, but is the environment completely on a flux where it's just, it's going to be gone and there's nothing we can do to help it? Or can we actually, you know, put in some protections to help? So
absolutely. And I mean, it's to me, it's, I didn't really want to do remote sensing that much. I'd prefer to be in the wetlands myself, generally.
Yeah.
But what a tool. I mean, to be able to look back, we have imagery of every spot on Earth every 11 days going back 40 years.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's like a tool that you can't pass up.
Yeah, it definitely helps, I feel like, with that research puzzle. Like, I feel that way with what I'm doing because, like, these chemicals have been around since World War II, but then it's just, like, pieces everywhere of just, like, well, they took, you know, this variable at this time and this time. And then, but then, you know, we're in 2020 today and they're like, oh, well, these are still emerging contaminants. And I'm like, well, how is that really possible if they were like forming these during World War II to make the Manhattan bomb? Like, I need a little more, you know, I guess it's emerging if you think about it on a different time scale.
Yeah.
But it's a, yeah, it's definitely interesting. I love wetlands, and I think one area that I really think that policy can really help is with the living shorelines and helping to increase wetlands. And for those of you that don't know what living shorelines are, so there's different laws on if your land, your private land, and this can apply to public in some ways, backs up against water. You know, it used to be, you know, if you have your house, you see people with what's called like a bulkhead, right? Like it's just grass and then it goes straight down and it's water, and that is kind of like a little wall between your land and the water. And sometimes those fail over time due to, you know, like depending on how much wave energy it's getting or just erosion. And now they've kind of tried, people are trying to incentivize that instead of depending on the land, people don't put the bulkheads in, that they kind of build their own shoreline, again, using different materials, using grasses, and in many times using oyster reefs, because they help stabilize the environment and stuff. Have you done any work with living shorelines?
Yeah, and I'm kind of looking at, we're starting some research on them now, but the concept of living shorelines, I think, really helps to explain why wetlands are important.
Yeah.
So, as you said, bulkheads fail. The other thing is that a bulkhead can never grow. Whereas living shorelines, as the plants grow, as the roots below the ground grow, they actually lift the sediment surface vertically. And then as water comes in and out, it'll deposit sediment, and the same thing. So basically with a living shoreline, you're not only getting protection, but you're getting kind of adaptive protection. So it'll increase its elevation through time. And similarly, if you're talking about oysters, those oysters will form a stronger reef, and more oysters will attach and grow. And so,
and they will clean.
And they will
as
clean.
We kind of mentioned in our previous podcast about beach pollution, about me please reminding people to please do not put your dog poop in the water. No one wants to swim in that.
Yes.
You know, so the oyster, you know, they definitely help. So what, to kind of go back to your research, what is kind of the research question you're asking right now in your postdoc work?
So the research question I'm focused on the most right now is basically what is happening in terms of climate change and coastal wetlands. So that's kind of a multifaceted question. One thing that we're focused on and we are submitting a paper on is that we've been looking at hurricane impacts to mangroves across the entire North Atlantic. So that's mostly Caribbean, the Gulf of Mexico, and the U.S. Florida.
Yeah, Florida.
And also a little bit in Texas, Louisiana.
Oh, really? There are some in Texas?
Yeah, they've expanded there, so that's kind of part of
my PhD. Oh, that's interesting. I never knew that. So, yeah, are we, just a quick question, are we seeing wetlands, though, starting to grow in other areas?
Yeah, that's critical. So the best way, we know now that there's kind of a limit to how much sea level rise wetlands can take in place. So, and we are seeing some wetlands die off where they exist along the coast. But at the same time, we're seeing wetlands move inland. And in the case of mangroves, we're seeing them move to higher latitudes. So areas that used to be too cold for them.
Yeah.
Because they can't handle freezing temperatures. But basically, mangroves, if we can preserve areas for them to migrate into, even if they're lost at the coast, then potentially they can be reestablished elsewhere to become wetlands inland or further north, et cetera.
That'll be interesting to see what happens, because I know we've talked about that on this podcast, that, you know, species are migrating a little bit, and we're starting to see that. And I remember when I was studying coral reefs, they too were starting to migrate in areas that they hadn't been seen before, which in one way could be helpful, because then they could help some of these species that rely on them. But in other ways, you know, what about in areas where they were traditionally more found?
Yeah, you know, that's exactly a great point. So in this paper that we're almost done with from the state of Florida, we looked at mangrove change, and 91% of mangroves gained. So overall, there are more mangroves in Florida than there were 40 years ago.
Oh,
so that's
positive. Yeah.
But 91% of that gain has come towards the interior. We've lost a lot of mangroves along the coast, and we've lost some of the oldest, biggest, most important mangroves along the coast. And the majority of that damage actually came during Hurricane Irma in 2017. So a lot of our research right now is following up on that. So we've been going back to these dead forests in the Florida Everglades that died during Hurricane Irma. We've been returning to them, and they're not coming back.
Wow.
So 60% of all of the damage in the state of Florida, long-term loss of mangroves, came in that one hurricane. So the big question is for the future, was that a particularly bad storm? And we know it was a bad storm, but was it usually when mangroves get hit by storms, they come back?
Yeah.
New trees replace the old ones. But we're wondering if this is based on sea level rise and the ecosystem being close to a tipping point, that when these ecosystems get hit by a big storm, then they potentially change forever. And maybe we're going to see more examples of that in the future. We hope not. There's also some aspects about the places where we had long-term mangrove loss that humans have impacted those areas. So it could be that removing the human impact can make all the difference, but it may also be that we're going to see huge changes in coastal wetlands during our lifetimes.
Oh, wow. So what do you think? I mean, this is sometimes like a little daunting to think about some of these like loss of ecosystems. And I think, you know, it's not just us, it's scientists that really value these places. I think a lot about, you know, hunters and fishermen too, that they value it. I mean, I personally would actually love to go duck hunt like in Louisiana where you were talking about. I think it's really fascinating and cool. And I know there's a lot of money in those kind of sports as well. What do you think a person can do to kind of help with the wetlands and kind of limit their own human impact if they do live in some of these coastal areas?
Yeah. As you mentioned, I work with a lot of hunters. We work with an organization called the Audubon Society, and we interact with a lot of hunters. We also we're working on restoration of some of the local North Carolina marshes, because in some ways they're really important migratory bird habitat, and sometimes people like to shoot those birds.
Yeah, so maybe this was one area where the, you know, Audubon and like Ducks Unlimited could come together and hopefully help, you know, work on creating and saving some of our wetland areas.
Absolutely, yeah. Everybody has to be involved. It's always, you know, often if I'm studying a transition from marshes to mangroves or looking at marshes and speak to hunters or fishermen, it's important to kind of think about the message that you're sending. So we want everyone to care about wetlands. So if people are not that interested in climate change, maybe talk about how it impacts something that they do care about.
Yeah. I think most people, I mean, I think it's hard because we're a little biased because we like grew up near the coast. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit harder if you're in some of those other areas, you know, like in the Midwest, for example. I lived there for a long time. And, you know, I think this is where here we see more of the impacts a lot of climate change. Mm-hmm. And when you're in the middle of the country, sometimes you're thinking about other stuff. Maybe you're thinking about the heat. Maybe you're seeing like the lack of rain, and that's not coming down on the farmland. And you know that that wetland definition affects farmers too. Sometimes not in the best way either, because they're just trying to provide crop. But I agree that it's got to be kind of a team effort to kind of protect these so that we can both use this the environment to our benefit, you know, both economically, socially, culturally, all those things we've kind of touched upon today. And so, you know, we've kind of talked about how much you like, we both value wetlands and everything, and kind of how you got to getting to study these and getting to, you know, travel and study mangroves. We have a motto here on All Swell, where there's a will, there's a wave, you know, to kind of keep going. What advice would you give to somebody younger going through kind of maybe the research journey or just trying to figure out what they'd like to do, or advice that you'd like to give your younger self?
Well, there's all kinds of things that I've learned from the hard way, but I'll say that maybe the most important thing in terms of being a scientist or being involved in whatever way you are with coastal ecosystems and restoration, et cetera, is just don't expect to solve all the problems at once on your own. And to go along with that, to savor any small victories. So things are difficult. We've been working as hard as we can to protect wetlands and to research them. And in some ways, that's all we can do. We can provide good, topical, important research and reach out to express what we find. That's all we can do. That's the most important thing you can do as a scientist, to teach, to have your outreach, and to do good, pertinent research. You can't necessarily also be the politician, the legislature, the judge,
I agree,
the president, all at once. So that can be incredibly frustrating. I had no idea that people would still be debating the existence of climate change at this point. But we're moving things forward. So by continuing to do good research and teach and promote ecology, we're creating that change, even if we haven't fully saved the planet yet.
I think that we come together in understanding our environment is just by having conversations with each other. I think that's been the negative of social media and our media right now, is that it's been more of a screaming match of one side or the other. Yeah. Even in the, like you just said, like some people aren't sure about climate change, right? And so it's like, well, why is that? And are they willing to have an open conversation? And is there someone who's better at communicating or just open to listen and hear their side of the story as well? Because, you know, like I mentioned, the U.S. is so diverse in its environment that, you know, sometimes people aren't seeing the same kind of impacts every day,
right,
of stuff. And so I really like, your advice about getting the small victories, too. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important because, like, I think when you're going through
you know, being in school and then leaving school and maybe like trying something else out and you're like, oh, maybe I don't want to go back to school. Like just getting those, maybe it is a side job that isn't really close to your, you know, research topic, but, you know, it brings happiness to your life and it's going to give you that push to keep going further. Or, you know, you learn that some area wetland did grow and that it's going to protect some other certain area. I think that's really cool advice. And if anyone out there in North Carolina would like to hear more about kind of resilient communities, PFAS, and other stuff that's going on with like marine spatial planning, the Coastal Society is hosting a forum on priority issues in North Carolina on November 6th at UNCW Center for Marine Science. So mark your calendars. It's going to be really exciting to see that. It's going to be with academics, people from nonprofits, people from the local municipalities, and also people that work kind of in the private sector as well. And it will be followed by a networking happy hour. And so you can find the registration link on the coastalsociety.org, and it will also be on our social medias. Sean, thank you so much for coming on today. It was really cool. I feel like we could talk about wetlands like all day.
Absolutely. So thank you so much.
If you're interested and want a part two, please reach out to us. And as always, where there's a will, there's a wave.